Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented to you by Cooper Tires and the Justice Brothers, makers of fine additives, cleaners, and lubricants for the automotive, heavy equipment, agricultural, and industrial worlds. We have an episode of Catching Up, our somewhat short-form interview series where someone of interest, in this case, my pal Tony Calderon, executive producer of the brand new documentary, The Gentleman Driver, which just hit Netflix within the last few days. So I rang Tony and we captured a little bit about the behind-the-scenes aspect of making The Gentleman Driver, what went into it, a little bit about the costs. We don't get into any numbers, but just a general understanding of what it entailed, the thought process, how they chose the four main people, the four main gentleman drivers in the documentary, and everything that it ended up being, some of the decisions on how to do what they did. Really enjoyed the call with Tony. I've known him for probably 15 years or so, back when he was the communications director for the Players Forsythe Champ Car team, so great to see him heavily involved today, not only as a driver manager, as a team manager, but now also as an executive producer of a documentary. So if you haven't seen The Gentleman Driver, strongly recommend it. Did some fine work here. Get to see some aspects of the people competing in the FIA WEC, IMSA's WeatherTech Sports Car Championship, and others, those who are not full-time pros, those who actually earn their living doing other things and then use their success and the proceeds to climb into sports cars and race at Le Mans, at Daytona, Sebring, you name it. So good on Tony for putting this together, and also interesting to hear that there are plans in the works to do more. So can't wait to see those as well. All right, let's get going with Tony Calderon, Catching Up episode, brought to you by the Cooper Tires Company and our pals at the Justice Brothers. Tony Calderon, it's pretty cool to think that you have a documentary in the world about motor racing that, by and large, seems to be very positively received. I finally got a chance to watch it long after you said, "Hey, idiot, watch it." Let's start there, man. Where did this idea start batting around as a full-length documentary concept?
Well, first of all, thanks, Marshall. I appreciate it. It all started in June of 2015. I was at the 24 Hours at Le Mans. I was managing Ricardo Gonzalez, who's one of the gentleman drivers in the documentary, and he had won the 24 Hours at Le Mans in 2013, and if he would have won it in 15, he would have become the first ever Mexican driver to win it twice. And we had a pretty good shot. We were racing with G-Drive, with Pipo Derani and Gustavo Yacaman as teammates. So, I mean, you know, it was a solid team, and it was a possibility to win it for sure. So I told him, hey, you know, if we do win it, we should have some kind of camera crew or something following you around, just in case, you know, because it'd be cool to document it from kind of behind the scenes. So I asked my friends at Bella Cartel, which is a production company out of Austin, if they wanted to come to France for a couple of weeks. And of course they said yes. you know, so we started kind of making a plan where we could film and, you know, what would kind of the theme of this, whatever with the end piece would be. And more importantly, obviously, if he didn't win it, then, you know, what the hell were we going to talk about? And I started at that point, you know, Ricardo, he had won the race a couple of years before, and Pipo and Gustavo, even though they were the pros and Ricardo was the amateur in the car, they were rookies at the race. So I told my friends, you should ask him about this. It's kind of a weird dynamic that even though Ricardo's the gentleman driver, he actually has more experience at this track and with this race and his two, like, sort of like superstar rookie teammates. And then my friends, who knew nothing about racing, that's when they told me, like, well, what is this whole concept about having a gentleman driver and professionals? That's crazy. And it just, you know, it kind of clicked that, yeah, for us in the racing world, we kind of take that for granted. In sports cars, we all know you have pro-am lineups, and that's just kind of the way it works. But for the outside world, it is a crazy concept. You know, like we say in the movie, you can own a football team, but you can't pay to be the quarterback of the Super Bowl. Yeah, this doesn't work like that, but in racing you can, you know, you can pay and you can race at the 24 Hours of Le Mans against the best drivers in the world, and because it's a pro-am category, it's you know, it that's just the way it goes. So So we decided to focus on that a little bit. We got a bunch of interviews. I called a bunch of friends that were gentlemen drivers, and we just kind of like scrambled to get a bunch of interviews while we were at Le Mans. And we came back to Austin, and we kept thinking, you know, this, there's something here, you know, to this. Hopefully somebody will make a documentary about this. Maybe we can give it, you know, give the footage to somebody or give somebody the idea. And we kind of came up with a little sort of pseudo trailer of what the documentary would look like. And we quickly realized that, one, it was a really cool concept, and two, nobody was going to do it unless we did it. So we came up with a budget, and once we figured out kind of how we could do it and what it would cost, I went out into the racing world and talked to some potential investors, and a few days later, everybody loved it, and I had the budget, and now we were stuck with filming it. So we kind of, we never thought it would happen, and then we were just stuck with it, and we said, okay, now what?
So I've had the opportunity of working with one of the four drivers chosen in this, Mike Gouache, and you also had Ed Brown, driver, co-owner of the Tequila Patron ESM team, plus CEO of Patron. You also had Paul Dalla-Lana with his Northwest real estate company, and also, you know, he's driven for many teams. Folks probably know our the friendly Canadian there. You obviously mentioned Monsieur Gonzalez as well. Looking across the four that you chose, I just found it interesting in their very different personalities, right? You might think going in, before you click play, whether it's on Netflix or wherever else folks might catch it now, might think, oh, gentlemen drivers, gentlewoman drivers, they'd all be cut from the same cloth. What I enjoyed, and tell me if there was, you know, articulate planning to get this, or if it just worked out that way, but yeah, they might all be successful in business. These are four very different people. I mean, I don't know if any one of them would naturally gravitate towards one another as friends, just because their personalities are very different, their backgrounds are very different. They all seem wired in a very different way, which I thought really only added to the quality of the documentary, instead of it being just four voices being very similar, almost one and the same.
No, you're absolutely right. And yeah, I mean, from day one, for sure, one of the goals when we said, okay, when we decide who's going to be in this, they have to be gentlemen drivers, but at the top of their game, both in business and in racing, right? So not just some guy that does some, you know, weekend sort of track warrior. Like, no, this has to be the top of the top. So obviously these guys, you know, WEC and IMSA and ELMS, and also they have to be somebody that are, you know, very impressive in business as well, because we want people to be inspired by them and to learn from them and all that. So that's kind of how we figured these four out. But that was, but like what you said, the sort of difference in personalities between the four, and the different backstories and the different approaches that they all take to the racing and to their lives, was just something that, you know, ended up being really cool. And it obviously, like you said, it helped the movie a lot, and it's been really cool because when I, you know, now that the movie's been out, we've had an amazing amount of feedback from, you know, thousands of people commenting on it and all that, and it's like a movie. Every person you talk to has they have a different favorite, like a different, like there are characters in a movie, you know. Some people love Mike, some people love Paul, some people love Ricardo, some people think Ed is a badass. So it's been really cool, like depending on the personality, people sort of relate to one of the four. And yeah, that's one of the main surprises that we've had. And but like you said, that just makes for a better film, so I'm just really happy that it happened that way.
Let's talk about you a little bit here, Tony. And as I mentioned in the open, I got to know you for the first time, I don't know, again, 12, 13, 14, 15 years ago. You were looking after PR and such for the Forsyth Players team and Champ Car. And after that, watched your career, whether it's doing PR, whether it is doing driver management, whether it's, you know, a variety of things. Not that I ever had any limits placed on my expectations for you, but producer, maker of feature-length documentaries wasn't necessarily something that came to mind back then. What has this been like for you? Was this a long-held desire you had to do something like this? Did you have the skills that you felt already in position to be able to do this? Were you learning heavily? What was this like, man?
No, well, first of all, Absolutely, it never came to mind to me either back then, for sure. I mean, honestly, it's been a pretty amazing journey, if you want to call it that. You know, when it all started, it just seemed like a cool idea and something that, you know, would be a fun little project, which then turned into a much bigger project that was fun sometimes, and it was incredibly frustrating sometimes. For me, no, I had zero experience. I mean, you know, what I tell everybody, I've always just been a huge documentary nerd. You know, I try to watch as many as I can. My fiance is too, so we watch a lot of them together, and it's very cool. So I always had sort of a very clear idea or vision of what a documentary would look like if somebody else made it, you know, about Gentlemen Drivers, and specifically this idea that I had, and if I watched it on Netflix, kind of what it would be about and how the story would develop. And I just kind of worked backwards from that, like I said, without necessarily having, with absolutely not having any experience. But I think if you have a good idea of what it can look like, if, you know, as long as you learn a little bit of the nuances of filmmaking, but also more importantly, you know, get the right team to do it, it can be done. So, I mean, honestly, it started from something that was just, like I said, a crazy idea, to now something that, I mean, it's probably, you know, what I'm the most proud of in my career, because not only did it take so long to make it, you know, it was a very long project, but like I said, you know, a lot of what I do in racing, I'm very proud of as well, and what we've done with Speed Group is very interesting, but it's just kind of day-to-day stuff, and we, you know, we help a lot of drivers and they've been successful and stuff, but you know, you go to a race and then the race is over and you move on, and then you finish the season and maybe you win the championship or not, but you move on. But I really feel like this is something that can be more timeless and something that I can actually, you know, influence the industry and the sport. And like I said, you know, if worst case scenario, this creates a few new gentleman drivers and gets more people into the sport and gives more teams and crews work, then, you know, I've kind of left my seed in the industry and hopefully made a name for myself. And yeah, it's very cool.
So before I get into some questions about the documentary itself and some of the aspects that I found interesting, let's talk about budget, right? How do you outline what you think this is going to be, knowing that, as you mentioned to start, this was initially a, hey, if you win Le Mans twice, then this, we need to document this. So the firing up cameras, getting, you know, cameramen, women, sound people, you know, getting a call it smallish crew assembled to do one specific thing at one event, that's one budget. Then obviously expands to, well, let's do something a lot bigger. What do you do there to try and raise the money? Were you able to forecast what the budget would be accurately from the outset? Did that slip and slide at all? I mean, this is the kind of stuff that fascinates me to understand.
So we had a good idea of sort of what it would take, what we thought it would take to film this and how we would do it. We said, okay, what if we follow these guys to three or four races during, you know, at the end of the 15th season and then towards the beginning of the 16th season, and then if we go to all of their homes and businesses at least once and do that, and then, so we had a good idea of kind of what we needed to film, and we worked the budget around that, and for that I was completely, you know, just basing it on, like I said, Velde Cartel, my production company. They did a lot of research on what it would take and all that stuff. So we actually, honestly, towards the end of the whole filming, we ended up going over budget, but not too much. I think I think we went over budget about only 10% from what was originally forecasted, which from everybody that I've talked to in the industry, that, you know, you hear these horror stories that, you know, things just cost double what you think it would. But for us, I mean, it was pretty simple. We had a budget, and I just told everybody, like, look, this is it. It's got to work. You know, we have to make it work. For sure, surprisingly, the filming part of it, we stuck to it pretty well, because like I said, we already had a plan, and I just told like I said my director and everybody, like, look, this is it. Like, you have to get enough footage. And when we were at the racetracks, I was running around also, you know, trying to talking to the teams and talking to the series and all that, making sure that we had as much content as we could. The post production part was trickier for sure, because that is a lot. It's not nearly as tangible, and because it's not a scripted film, you know, it's not like you have a script and you just edit it and that's it, right? You're basically, we had over 100 hours of footage, and we needed to come up with an hour 20, you know, tell a story, and you can probably come up with 100 different stories, right, with 100 hours of footage. So it's how to get the right one and how to condense it and get the right editing and music and color correction. And then, you know, we made a lot of mistakes, so we had to go back. So I mean, I did have to get pretty creative with it, but like I said, luckily somehow we managed to make it work. I mean, a lot of credit to the team. I mean, you know, everybody, we all thought it was going to be a year and a half project. It ended up being 3.5 years, and everybody got paid the same, whether it was a year and a half or 3.5 years. So wow. Everybody just, you know, put in a lot of time. And yeah, like I said, I think we just got lucky. And one of the things that I keep telling everybody, you know, this is a very low budget documentary compared to some other stuff that you'll see on Netflix. But we got super creative. And like I tell everybody, like, yeah, we had a low budget documentary on the production side of it, but we have a $50 million set or whatever, you know, whatever it is when you're filming around the WEC and IMSA and the ELMS, right? So that ups the production value quite a bit. And also we had a lot of support, obviously, from WEC, like I said, and from ELMS and IMSA with getting a lot of the footage right. And John Heindorf was a huge help for us with helping us with a lot of the narration and all that. So I just knocked on every single door I knew to make it happen, basically.
Let me continue on this theme a little bit, because this two other things stand out. So you mentioned getting access and rights and such. As someone who has, whether it's working to negotiate a driver contract or whatever it might be, you know, you certainly have a lot of experience on that side of the business. What did you find when you're having to enter into this with a 24-hour Le Mans, again, many of the series and sanctioning bodies you mentioned, from a film production standpoint? Because it's a lot different than, hey, we want an in-car camera for the race, how much is it going to cost? This is, you know, can be a very expensive proposition in gaining rights to film and have the rights to use everything that we see. Then we also hear sometimes, and I don't know if this is the case here, where a sanctioning body, a track or otherwise, might say, hey, you know, normally it would be this high number, but this sounds like a good thing you're doing. It could help the sport. It could help us. It could, you know, this is going to have a positive benefit. We're going to do our best to help you on that number to do this, because we think what you're doing actually is going to give back more value than just trying to get as many dollars out of your pocket. What was that like?
You know, I'm not allowed to divulge specifically that because of the contract. However, what I can say is, yes, just like you said, I mean, obviously, I was lucky enough that by the time I started doing this, I knew the people at the WEC really well, and the same as IMSA and ELMS, so I could have very, you know, high-level conversations with them. And everybody, like you said, they were very supportive of the project. You know, at first they just said, "Look, let's just see what you can do. Go for it, film it, and then we'll talk later." Which always made me a little nervous, for sure, right? But I think I sort of laid out to them kind of what the vision was and what the project was and who was involved and all that. And you know, it was all serious people, but none of us had any experience with it. So I think everybody had a little reservation to see what the final product would be like. But I think once everybody saw how it came out, we had incredible support from everybody. And yes, they made it easier than I think they would have perhaps for an outsider. And like you said, and I think everybody understands that this is good for the just for the industries in general, whether it's one series or the other one, or whether it's high level or lower level racing. Like I said, at worst, if it just gets more people into the sport, you know, it just, you know, rises the tide for everybody.
So as an executive producer, Tony, what are your thoughts or what are you, well, if I should say, pitching to, you know, investors or whomever else that, that are helping to make this possible? But what's your mindset when we're looking at the finished product? Is it we want to get this in as many theaters as we can and hope to recoup, you know, maybe make a profit from ticket sales? Is it trying to partner with, you know, some good streaming services that might be able to help in that direction? I ask because we see some racing documentaries that come out that are beautiful things, and we know that for the most part, they're never going to make their money back, but we thank them for giving us beautiful or any entertaining things to watch. Just curious what you and your team's mindset was going into this and whether making it a financially solvent thing, something that was in the black, was a goal or a possibility?
At first, we weren't quite sure. And like I said, it's, you know, I had just amazing trust from our investors to just let me see what we could come out of it and hopefully make something that was good for the industry and for everybody and try to make the money back. But luckily, I had flexibility on that because a lot of people just did this for the love of the sport, which is incredible. So that's always an easier point to start, right? I had no idea when we started this that we could sell it to Netflix and make significant return on it. It was just really about, you know, to see what comes out of it. And honestly, when I started, I said, look, hey, if we can just put it up on YouTube and people watch it and we get some views and that leads to other opportunities for everybody, then why not, right? And then as things developed, now it's real, right? And yes, when you go to Netflix, you you know, it's not a charity case. They buy it from you, and you know, is it the best business in the world? Probably not, but it definitely opens up a lot of doors for everybody. And it changed the way that I look at it, and now I'm looking in initial stages at looking at how do we sort of grow this franchise and turn it into some type of sequel or some type of TV series with the same concept, but, you know, with bigger production value, and hopefully now with the Netflix release, it can lead to bigger and better things. And I'm definitely looking at it now with a much more of a business or entrepreneurship eye, for sure, than just sort of a passion project.
Hashtag gentlewoman racer. Okay, I want some sort of credit for that if that ends up being the title for the second one. Let's go back to the documentary itself, Tony, which of the many themes that were explored, I think one that I enjoyed seeing the veil pulled back on the most, possibly, was on the topic of acceptance. So, having worked as a race car mechanic since I was, you know, in my teens in high school, and then that moving into, you know, full-time professional race car mechanic working for prep shops and such at a Sears Point and whatnot, a lot of gentlewoman drivers were the core of the business. So from essentially my earliest days, being that mechanic, running the person who's the head of this company, the head, you know, has this hedge fund, whatever it is, that's something that's been part of my life since almost day one in racing. And you and through Ed Brown and some of the questions being asked in one of the dinner settings when you all sat down for a meal that you recorded, so revealing to hear Ed mention, and I think just about everyone mention, how much it meant to them to have the pro driver or pro drivers that they partner with in their entry to mention, hey, great stint, great job, amazing lap times you turned, something where, drawing back to your comment about you might be able to buy an NFL team, but you can't buy your way onto the field. Tell us a little bit about this particular story arc of acceptance and how you saw it play out among the four main characters in the documentary. Because each one of them shared in their own way how, yes, they can buy their way in. That's why they're here. But having the pros say, you know, the job you just did, that was just like one of us, seemed like that almost meant more than anything, and all the money they've ever spent on racing was worth it in those moments.
Yeah, you know, one of the, we knew from almost from day one that one of the biggest challenges to make this a film that people will like and would be to sort of make these guys' stories as human as possible, because it's very easy to see basically a bunch of rich guys that race expensive cars on TV and, you know, sort of see that in a negative sense and not relatable at all, right, for the average person. And so we knew that coming in, so we were very adamant in exploring sort of that human angle of saying, like, okay, yes, these guys are rich, yes, they, you know, obviously they live very very sort of unattainable lives for most people, but there's a lot more to it, right? Like, it's not that easy. And that line that you talk about from Ed is one of my favorite ones in the movie, because here you have this super successful, almost celebrity CEO, right, that runs one of the biggest, or built one of the biggest brands in the world, and he's and in the office, you know, he's looked at as a hero, right?
His teeth are more valuable than me as a human being. Like, you know, this guy's pinky hole possesses more value than anything that I will do in my life. And yet, again, someone who has everything in the world can buy anything. Shoot, I think owns everything in the world. What means the most? Johannes von Overbeck saying, "Awesome job." And meaning it. Again, regardless of how much money these guys have.
We wanted to spur that because, like I said, this guy goes from being the number one at the office that everybody's just basically sucking up to coming to the track where, you know, they're basically sort of the weak link, right?
Yep.
They're usually the slower guy in the track. They're the ones that make the most mistakes. They are, you know, the ones that are not professional. So they have to sort of, you know, lower their standing, let's say, to, like Ed says, we're just one of the team. You know, just one of them. I just want to be humble, and I want to learn from Johannes or from Pipo Derani, who's, you know, imagine Ed Brown at his age making billions of dollars, and Pipo Derani at 22 years old telling him what to do, right? that dynamic I thought was super interesting.
Get me an espresso, kid. Oh, wait a minute, you're my teammate. Sorry, okay, hold on, never mind. Yeah, no, I love that theme. The other thing that I enjoyed too, and maybe share some thoughts about this, we know that for the most part a gentleman or gentlewoman driver has been a success in life or has been born into wealth and opportunity. One of the two. You're not there because you are the world's greatest race car driver. You're there because you have been a success in something other than race car driving, have the ability to pay to be there, and then start your own journey to become as good as possible. The fact that you not just had the folks talk about their businesses and what they did, and then tried to draw some parallels between how they've succeeded in business and then try to bring that to racing. The fact that you went to, you know, Mexico to show the Patron campus, the fact that you spent time with Mike Gouache and his new company and went to Canada with Dalalana and such, I really enjoyed seeing that side because we kind of don't ever get to see it. Tell us about that, not only decision, but maybe also the reason where you let that really become a much bigger part of the documentary than just it being 90% race cars and on track and a small sliver of what they do day to day to be able to facilitate that racing.
You know, to me, that was always the most important part of it, because, like, we, you know, when even from day one when we started filming this, you know, people would come up to us and say, like, oh, so is this kind of like Truth in 24 or like Senna? And I was like, no, I'm not even trying to compete against these big racing documentaries, because first of all, I have like a tenth of the budget, right? And second of all, I don't call this a racing documentary. This is a documentary about very interesting people that have racing in common, right? That they all just happen to race cars. And I knew, like I said, the niche that we have here and the really interesting thing is gentlemen drivers, not drivers. It's very successful businessmen that are so successful that they can afford to pay millions of dollars in racing, and people like that are just incredibly interesting, right? You don't get to be a successful CEO like this just by, you don't luck into it, right? I mean, you have to work really hard, you have to be very smart, you have to be very committed and driven. So yeah, in fact, every single meeting that we had, every single, in the budget, in the how we planned the shoots, it was almost like we had a line drawn down the middle, like, okay, this is the racing side of this is the business side of it. What's the parallel from one to the other? Even when we edit stuff, if you watch the trailer, there's a lot of cuts that go from business to racing. So we always kind of had that. That was almost like the core value of the movie is, this is 50% racing, this is 50% business. And we always have to stick to that. If not, it's just going to be a racing documentary that, you know, we're competing against a bunch of, you know, classics that there's no point to it, or it's just a business documentary that also, I mean, you know, we're just going into a realm here where it gets pretty tricky, but the combination between the two, nobody's ever done, and that's what we knew. We had a very special project here.
Let's close on this, Tony. So you've already mentioned that you've got some other ideas. Maybe could it be a follow-up documentary? Could it be a series? Whatever. Where do you see this filmmaking world evolving in your own life with all the things we've mentioned that you've done before in the sport? Could you see yourself, or do you envision yourself, you know, that proverbial 5 years out, where making these kinds of things, hopefully selling them to Netflix and others, is a much bigger slice of what you do? Or do you enjoy some of the current things that you do too much to diminish them on your day-to-day basis?
I like the combination of doing both, to be honest, and one thing helps the other. I could never have done this documentary if I didn't have sort of, you know, my racing career and the access that I have and the contacts that I've made and my day-to-day life at the track. And having this documentary is definitely giving me a lot of exposure, and not just me and my company Speed Group, a lot of credibility and just sort of, you know, showing what we do and what we're capable of to the racing world. So it's almost like one feeds on another. So, you know, I am definitely exploring other stuff because I love this experience, and I love the where it's gone. I know it's not going to be easy, so I'm not expecting it to always, you know, turn out to be this successful. But I really do think that, you know, this is something special and something that will be around forever. You know, gentlemen drivers will always be very interesting and will always be a part of racing because that's just the way the economics work in racing. So if I can keep exploring that opportunity, it could be cool. And look, it's really just not about racing. It's the entrepreneurial part of it that I love as well. And we've had so many people. I was talking to Mike Guash today. He's getting emails like crazy from people asking him for business advice and asking them if he can mentor them. And I've had the same personally and all these guys. And we always wanted to explore that, right? Make this something that just shows people that, hey, you know, if you work hard enough and you figure out how to grow your business and you're lucky and you're driven, you can go be a gentleman driver, or you can go sail the world, or you can go write a book. You know, the concept really starts opening up outside of racing. You know, gentleman driver is sort of like the excuse for us to show this content, but I really see it going outside of racing in general, and you can start combining with, like I said, with entrepreneurial groups and business groups, and we even had a school teacher in the inner school in Chicago saying, like, I want to show this to my kids just to show them that, you know, you can, you know, people can make go from rags to riches and things like that. So I mean, that's just been sort of the icing on the cake for me, because it's, yeah, how cool is that, you know, that you can inspire inner city kids in schools by making a racing documentary. That's just amazing to me.
Tony, so happy for you, man. You've always been one of the good ones. You've always been a fine and upstanding member of the motor racing community. So it makes me happy whenever I see someone like you aim like really high, reach very high, trying to do something that is aspirational and not only succeeds in it, but kicks ass with it. So looking forward to whatever it is that you happen to make next with your team there. And thanks for knocking this out, man. It was very, very enjoyable to watch. And I think you got a good eye for whatever it is that we might see in the future.
No, thank you very much, my friend. I really appreciate that. And I hope everybody go watch it, The Gentleman Driver on Netflix. And I would love to, you know, just, we're on Facebook and Instagram. Leave us a comment. We, you know, it's so cool to get feedback from race fans and from non-race fans. It's just amazing. And thanks. I really want to thank the racing community because, I mean, it's been incredible. I mean, the movie's only been out for 4 or 5 days, and it's just blown up. I mean, I've had people from all over the world that have seen it, and like I said, just sort of the racing community has really embraced it and you know, shared it on social media. There's so many, you know, famous drivers and team owners and teams and manufacturers and brands that have that helped us spread the word, and it, you know, it really means a lot, and it's something we're super proud of. And I hope we can, like I said, hopefully this just helps raise the tide just a tiny bit for everybody in the racing world, and hopefully we get more people into the sport.